Hello, and welcome to the How to Register as a Broker-Dealer, ATS, or Exchange webinar presented by Polsinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer a CLE polling question. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling question. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling question. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Polsinelli shareholder and our FinTech and Regulation Practice, Richard Levine.
Thank you, Emma. There's an old song that the lyric begins, if you can't beat them, join them. Well, the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission has taken actions, enforcement actions, against a number of platforms that are trading digital assets, or what some people refer to as cryptocurrencies. In many of these actions, the SEC has said that the platform operators should have been registered as an exchange, a securities exchange, or they should have been registered as a broker-dealer operating an alternative trading system. Today, we're going to talk about how you actually can join them and register as a broker-dealer, an alternative trading system, or an exchange. We will be talking about what are digital assets, when are they securities, what is a broker-dealer. We'll be talking about FCC enforcement actions against trading platforms that didn't realize that they were an exchange. We'll be talking about what is an exchange, what are alternative trading systems, the process for registering as a broker-dealer, an alternative trading system, or an exchange. My name's Rick Levine. I'm the chair of the FinTech and Regulation Practice at Polsinelli, which is a group of lawyers across all practices that have come together to work with very large, sophisticated firms and very small and mid-stage firms that are all exploring the intersection of technology and financial services. At Polsinelli, we also like to stress that it's the FinTech and regulation practice because many of our clients have a very solid understanding of the technology, but they are new to the regulatory world. I'm joined by my colleagues, Peter Waltz and Dan McAvoy, who will introduce themselves. Peter? Dan, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. No problem. So I'm Dan McAvoy. I'm a shareholder in the New York office of Polsinelli. I'm a member of the FinTech and Regulation team, as well as the Investment Funds team and Security Regulation Practice Group. So we've been very excited to be discussing this. And let's see if we've got Peter back real fast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Peter Waltz. I'm a shareholder in our Securities Group and a member of our FinTech team. My practice currently focuses largely on private securities transactions and investment management issues, advising investment advisors, broker-dealers, and especially in the last several years, folks who are doing those activities in the FinTech space. Back to you, Dan.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Peter. So the very first thing that we're going to talk about here just a little bit is, well, what exactly is a security? As you may know, you would have to deal with the SEC and potentially have registration issues where the instruments that are being sold or traded is a security. And this may be at both the federal and the state level where a number of these laws apply. So when the Securities Act was written back in 1933, they included a number of these sort of normal things that you would consider to be securities back then. So you have stock and notes and securities, futures and bonds and things like that. But what they didn't know was what the future was going to hold in terms of types of instruments that people may try to purchase for investment purposes. And so they included in that the category of investment contracts. So if you go ahead and you look at the definition here, it doesn't even include partnership interests, for example. And that's part of the reason is that, well, is this something that's an investment contract? Now, it took a little while for them to figure out, okay, well, exactly what is an investment contract? I mean, it could be all different types of things. And of course, as one might expect, the SEC historically and still does try to take as broad of a definition of investment contract as they can, because the goal of the SEC in part is to, not only to facilitate capital raising and to ensure smooth markets, which is a large piece of the reason behind broker-dealer registration, but also to protect investors. And so the investor protection prong generally leads them to try to use an expansive definition of security. A number of years after the Securities Act had passed, there was a Supreme Court case, which is called the Howey case. It still, despite the fact that it's 1946, still is the leading case and still is the case that people look to in order to determine whether or not something is an investment contract. And so what they said, what the Supreme Court said there is that an investment contract is a contract, transaction, or scheme where a person invests money into a common enterprise that is led to expect profits solely from the efforts of a promoter or third party. So basically, this is a four-part test when you take a look at it, because you need the investment, you need the commonality, you need the expectation of profits. And you need a third party who is going ahead and pushing things forward in order to drive the value of the investment. So each of these prongs has over time expanded as a general matter. And, there are certain courts that take a more liberal view, and there are certain courts that take a much stricter view. But a number of these things have pretty much been held in common. So, for example, an investment of money doesn't need to be cash. It doesn't need to be fiat. It doesn't need to be anything else like that. In fact, it doesn't even need to be security or money. It can be another security. It can be a commodity. It just needs to really be something of value that you're going ahead and providing as a separable in return for getting a separable financial interest. So it's already been decided specifically that digital currencies can be money for these purposes. So there, for example, was a case fairly early on that making investments in Bitcoin would still constitute an investment of money, even though what they were paying in was Bitcoin and not paying in the form of traditional fiat currency. The expectation of, well, they go to the common enterprise real quick. The common enterprise, we're not discussing too much, and we'll discuss a bit more when it comes down to showing when a digital asset itself is deemed to be a security. But there are a couple of different ways that people can look at this, which is, well, do you have commonality because, say, for instance, you've got a bunch of owners who are working together? Or do you have commonality because there are a bunch of people who have the same thing? It is really kind of the most basic way to boil those down. And if you've heard of vertical commonality and horizontal commonality, so as Peter will point out, that's been largely ignored when it comes to digital assets. So we don't go into that too much here. The expectation of profits can be capital appreciation from the investment, or it can be the fact that it is being traded separately and you may be able to get a profit by selling it at a premium at some point in the future. Under Howey itself, I mean, Howey test, what this guy was doing is he was selling plots of land in an orange grove. And telling people, hey, well, I'll go ahead and sell the oranges for you. And at some point in the future, I'll go ahead and sell the land and you'll make money off of that too. Well, that test had both aspects of the expectations of profits. But over time, the courts have come to find that you can have an expectation of profits, not only because you're going to be getting operating income or something like that, but also because there's the potential to get an increase in the value of your property that at some point later on down the line, you can go ahead and sell for a profit. So for example, if you buy something and plan on selling it on an exchange for a profit, that would pretty clearly meet the expectation of profit aspect of the Howey test. And then finally, you have from the efforts of a promoter or third party. Now, the original Howey test said it needed to be solely from the efforts of the promoter or third party. That solely has mostly flown out the window at this point. There does need to be some effort of a third party or of a promoter in order to go ahead and meet the definition of being a security. There are certain examples where somebody has enough of their own control over the profits that are going to be generated that it wouldn't be deemed to be from the efforts of a promoter or a third party because you yourself, the holder of the investment, are able to control, at least to some extent, the way that the profits are generated. And so there is a bit of a push and pull here. You know, there have been different cases in different places that have determined whether or not something is involved from the efforts of others. And for the most part, people kind of give a look at the economic reality of the transaction. So, you know, for example, there have been, you know, cases where a contract in one context, say, for example, if you have a timeshare and somebody's going to manage that for you and sell it and rent it out for you so you can make money off of it, well, that may be a security. If you're going to go ahead and use the timeshare on your own and for your own use, then it wouldn't be a security. So this has been kind of the prong that, you know, a lot of people have used to try and say that, one of the prongs anyway, that a lot of people have used to try and say, okay, well, our digital asset isn't a security. But however, as you will see in the next slide, you know, there is definitely a broad interpretation of when a digital asset is going to be a security. Take it away, Peter.
All right, thanks, Dan. You know, I was in thinking on our presentation today, I was reminded that the Howey test you were just speaking about over the years has been applied to a wide range of investment programs involving all sorts of good things, as from the orange trees you mentioned, but also chinchillas, minks, whiskey, beavers, condo units, but all when they were packaged, sold, and offered under circumstances that would involve an investment of money and creation of an expectation of return through the efforts of others. So, you know, moving away from whiskey and beavers, the SEC pretty recently, particularly starting in roughly 2017 during the ICO boom, and in the Dow report that Rick will talk about in a little bit, and through a lot of enforcement actions, such as against Munchie, AirFox, Paragon Coin, and a case getting some publicity today, Kick, that the Howey test and its analysis applies to digital tokens depending on the circumstances under which they are issued. Essentially, the SEC has said there really is no distinction in the application of the securities laws whether you're speaking about traditional offerings of stock or offerings of digital assets or SAFs. The upshot is an issuer and market participants have to comply with the securities regulations regardless of the form of the security. Bump us ahead slightly. So in addition to enforcement actions from the SEC, there have been a variety of public statements from SEC officials that have said that many, if not most, digital asset offerings and issuances, when scrutinized, have likely involved the issuance of securities. A prominent example of this is 2018, Bill Hinman, director of the SEC's Division of Corporate Finance, gave a speech where he spoke about digital assets and the applications of the securities laws to digital assets. And in that speech, he cited Howey, goes and went on to note that in many cases, the economic substance of a token sale or digital asset sale has been the same as a conventional securities offerings. Funds are raised with the expectation that promoters are going to pool those funds, build the system, and investors can then earn a return on what they purchased. usually by turning around and selling their digital assets in the secondary market after the promoter has created something of value with the proceeds, and the value in the use of that digital enterprise has increased. You know, although a digital asset itself is simply code, the manner and way it is sold often is part of an investment to non-users by promoters to develop some type of enterprise can be, and in that context, most often is a security because it would evidence an investment contract. You know, tacking on to Bill Hinman's speech, in a letter last spring, the SEC chairman essentially affirmed the Hinman speech and went on to state the Howey test is now the litmus test for detecting securities in the blockchain space. On its site, the SEC has a lot of good information about digital assets and their intersection with the securities laws. They have there the page entitled Spotlight on ICOs, lots of good stuff on the FinHub page. There's a spoof on ICOs entitled the Howey Coin. And there's also a framework the SEC has put out to help folks analyze whether a digital asset was sold as a security. Of the Howey test, that framework notes that token issuances typically the final prongs of the Howey test are the most relevant, i.e. being the efforts of others and the expectation of profits prong. In that guidance, the SEC reiterates a longstanding principle that it's going to look to the economic reality of a transaction and what character the investment is given by its terms, plan of distribution, economic inducements, et cetera. You know, a couple little nuggets to cite and point out in that framework. With respect to the efforts of others prong, the SEC's note says, we're going to look in particular at things like whether a sponsor is responsible for the development, improvement, enhancement of a given network, i.e. whether a third party is taking necessary steps for the network or the digital asset to achieve or retain some type of value or functionality. Also, the efforts of others prong of how we would likely be met where the network or the digital asset is still in development at the time, and the network or digital asset is not fully functional at the time of the offer or sale, particularly where a sponsor is going to essentially promise the further development efforts in order for the digital asset to attain or grow in value. Just a couple of examples that we pretty common in this space. You know, the sponsor essentially may be creating or supporting a market for the digital token or controlling supply, you know, things such as airdrops, token burns, etc. The sponsor essentially may be determining whether and where a digital asset will trade. Central sponsor maybe trying to monetize the value of the digital asset. But those were pretty typical things in the space, particularly a couple of years ago, and still some today. Quickly talking about a few of the issues raised in the framework in the expectation of profits prong of Howey, the framework points out the price appreciation can equate to an expectation of profits, particularly when influenced by the promoter. Token purchasers or digital asset purchasers typically have an expectation of profits where a digital asset is offered broadly to potential purchasers as compared to being targeted to expected users of the goods or services on a given platform. Just as an example, again, semi-common in the space, where a digital asset is offered and purchased in quantities that are really, when you break it down, indicative of an investment intent instead of indicative of use. You probably have an expectation of profits. And again, in the framework, the SEC highlights things like, are these digital assets really going to go and escape and be traded on third-party platforms, et cetera? So looking at all these criteria as a whole in the guidance, I think we can see that lots and lots of the digital assets that have been offered and sold over the years likely are and would be deemed securities in the eyes of the SEC. However, a little relief that came out of the Hinman speech and has gotten a lot of publicity although folks don't exactly know what it means, Hinman, and then reiterated by Chairman Clayton last spring, have indicated that if a given digital asset was sold as a security, it's possible that at some point in the future that can be reevaluated and that digital asset could cease to be a security where a given platform has become quote-unquote sufficiently decentralized and the efforts of a central party essentially no longer control the network or the given digital asset. So what does this mean? Well, where we are today, Bitcoin and Ethereum almost certainly aren't securities, but beyond that, no one really knows. So Rick, I'll go ahead and punt it over to you to speak a little bit more about the DAO where some of the SEC's guidance was born from. And
thank you, Peter. So I've been doing fintech since 1999, back when E-Trade was using chimpanzees to advertise and get people to believe that online trading was something that they could do, back when stocks were traded in fractions. And I was a 28-year-old kid when I got into this. And people thought we were crazy as kids saying that the future is computerized trading. We were proven right. But the problem we have to remember, and Peter and Dan have walked through this, the securities laws in the United States were written back in the days when guys wore leather football helmets and guys my size played professional football. Now we are dealing with a very different set of circumstances. And the Securities Exchange Commission has to regulate. They're given a rule book like an NFL referee, and the rule book was written in the 30s. So oftentimes what they are trying to do is set the tone through speeches, through informal guidance, through hypotheticals like the Howey coin, which was a spoof coin created to show that it would have violated the securities laws. So they're using multiple levers of soft guidance for the industry. When the DAO report came out, the first distributed autonomous organization that was created was called the DAO, the DAO. And when this was created several years ago, people called me out of the blue and said, Rick, what do you think? And I said, well, it's an illegal offering of securities. And they said, how can you say that? They're in Switzerland. They've been told by the mayor of Zug that it's okay to do it. And I said, that's like saying the king of, you know, Burger King telling people that a security is not a security means nothing. Then they said, well, wait a minute, they're not in America. They're Swiss and German nationals living in Switzerland. I said, yes, but they sold the DAO to American citizens. They offered securities into the United States. They have a problem. Now, we ended up having to represent people that were involved, and we knew what was going on, and we saw what the SEC was talking about. But then the SEC eventually published a report. And in the report, they made it very clear that this distributed autonomous organization, in effect, looked like a partnership, and it looked like it was offering securities that met the Howey test. And the fact that they were based on the Ethereum protocol was irrelevant. So when the SEC looked at the DAO, the DAO, and they published their report, they focused on a couple key points. They noted that the DAO was a for-profit entity which took in funds from investors in the form of the digital asset Ethereum in exchange for a divisible and freely transferable token, giving them ownership and voting rights. That was the key part of it. It looked like a security. Now, when they did the sale, they gained the equivalent of $168 million from individual investors in the offering. So this was the first wide-scale offering. 23,000 voting interests of the DAO were issued, and approximately half of the invested funds came from 70 Ethereum addresses. So 70 investors investing a large amount of money in what appeared to be a security. So then people said, hey, Rick, it's not a corporation. And I said, well, you have to remember, a hedge fund is typically offered, an interest in a hedge fund is a limited partnership interest, a partnership interest. But those interests in hedge funds are securities. So when they are sold to the public, they have to be sold in a manner that is compliant with the U.S. securities laws if they are being offered in the United States. So when the SEC published their DAO report back in 2017, this was a watershed moment. They said to the world that what the DAO offered was a security. It was subject to the Securities Exchange Commission's jurisdiction, and they relied on a couple of the cases that Peter and Dan mentioned earlier, one of them being Glenn W. Turner from the Ninth Circuit. I think it's 1972. There's another case called Cascott Interplanetary. And if you ever get bored and want to go read some funny cases, these are the cases to read, because these were multi-level marketing schemes, what some people would call a pyramid scheme. And in those cases, the Ninth Circuit, ruling on a case brought by the Securities Exchange Commission, said that the interpretation of what is a security under the Howey test is extremely broad. So when the SEC came into this world of digital assets and they started referring to Glenn W. Turner and Coscott, it didn't surprise people that have been doing this a long time, but it surprised people that are not familiar with the securities laws. So relying on the Howey test, the SEC said the determination of whether a token is a security is based on analysis of the facts and circumstances. Now, this is very hard for business people to wrap their arms around, because in many respects, it's like when you're a teenager and you don't have your own car and you go ask mom and dad for the keys to the car and they say, well, let's look at the facts and circumstances if you did a good job this week. So the SEC gets to make a determination of the facts and circumstances in deciding to bring an action against people who have issued tokens. In the Dow, the SEC said, but for the failure of the offering and the refunding of the Ethereum, they would have taken action against the issuers of the Dow tokens because it met the Howey test. So in the Dow, the other part that was interesting was that the SEC said, in, I believe it was footnote one, we are not going to comment on whether the Dow could have been an investment company under the Investment Company Act, meaning that it was a collective investment vehicle or scheme is what they refer to as in Europe, like a mutual fund. The fact that they put that into the report was a signal to everyone that if you are creating any type of collective investment vehicle involving digital assets that are securities, tokens that are securities, you need to think about the Investment Company Act. But in the Dow report, the more important part of it was they said that the Dow created a mechanism for bringing together multiple buyers and sellers of the tokens that were securities. And by virtue of that, the Dow should have registered as a securities exchange. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but I'm going to turn it back over to my colleague to talk about, so I'll turn it back over to Peter, I believe.
Oh, sorry, it's Dan. No problem. So before and after the Dow report, there have been a number of enforcement actions against digital assets, issuers, traders, exchanges, and things that facilitated the exchange of things that look like securities. Now, the posting of the Dow report was kind of a watershed moment for the SEC in terms of the way that it enforced these actions. Things that happened before the Dow report, you looked at them and you were like, well, that's very clearly a security. All that they're doing is selling stock. And then you're going ahead and just because it happens to be a smart contract, really this has the characteristics of equity. Afterwards, it became where the enforcement came was much broader, and they brought down the hammer much harder. Even though there were a number of people who and some practitioners who took the view that the Dow report really was just kind of, oh, hey, if you're a security, you need to follow securities laws, and still thought that, you know, there were some utility tokens and things along those lines that weren't really securities for the various reasons we described about the Howey test, they were wrong. In a nutshell, or at the very least, the position that the SEC has been taking with respect to things that one used to call utility tokens are that they're generally securities. And so far at this point, the courts have agreed. So one of the early actions here is BitQuick. So what they did is they went ahead and did a couple of offerings, and one of the offerings, it was essentially trying to serve as a Bitcoin exchange to some extent, but they also offered their own security to permit and allowed the trading of that. And that security basically served and looked a lot like an equity interest. So in this particular one, because they were allowing people to go ahead and buy and sell this token that looked a lot like equity, and it was a security, and because of the fact that there was quite a bit of losses here, ultimately they were found to have operated unregistered National Securities Exchange and got into pretty big trouble on that one. The next one, somewhat similar, although it, and this came partially after the Dow report, this one is ICO Box. So what they did is they went out there and set up a platform to help sell ICO tokens for third parties. So they said, hey, well, we've got, you know, our kind of whole soup to nuts solution here. We'll go ahead and put together the documentation for you. We'll go ahead and help you make sure that that your coding is sound, and we will go ahead and help market the tokens over our platform. And ultimately was able to sell quite a bit of tokens through that platform. Now, they accepted transaction-based compensation in respect of these ICOs, which is just a huge no-no. And ultimately, ICO Box lost a default judgment for its failure to register as a broker. Essentially, it acted as an illegal underwriter. By facilitating the initial coin offerings and then going ahead and selling this, marketing it, doing things that fit the various hallmarks of being a broker-dealer. And the founders ghosted and are hiding somewhere. The next one is BTC Trading Corp. Similar to some of these other ones, they were offering shares of crypto-related countries. So basically, this was mining companies and things along those lines that they were selling in exchange for Bitcoin and Litecoin. In a fair amount of their offering materials, they actually referred to these as stock exchanges. Of course, you know, being an exchange and kind of admitting that you're a stock exchange is going to lead to some serious issues. And of course, that, you know, as a result, they were found to be operating an illegal stock exchange. Ether Delta was the first enforcement action that a digital token trading platform was operating as an unregistered exchange. The secondary trading was for was basically they were doing this through ICO tokens that were all compatible with their platform. And what their idea was, hey, well, you know, this is just purely coding. We don't have an actual person that's controlling any of this. We just went ahead and put together a smart contract that automatically matches up buyers and sellers of ICO tokens. And yeah, we're taking a fee, but like there's no entity here. We just went ahead and set up a website and there's because there's no person there that they were kind of trying to argue that they weren't an exchange. And of course, as we saw with the Dow report, you don't actually need an entity in order to have an investment contract. And frankly, smart contract has the word contract in its name. So so ultimately, basically it allowed every ERC-20 token to be able to trade through that platform. It didn't matter, you know, what the token was. You didn't have to go ahead and get it pre-approved. You could go ahead and just stick it on there yourself and try and buy and sell. And ultimately, they too were found to be an online national securities exchange and went out of business and had sanctions imposed on them. The last one of the enforcement actions that have happened with respect to this is Bitfunder, which they were too selling Bitcoin-related enterprises. So while they were not trading in Bitcoin itself, people would go ahead and be able to use their Bitcoins to buy interest in other crypto companies, essentially. Once again, they permitted people to go ahead and buy and sell and match up the purchase price for these various digital assets that oftentimes related to the equity in these other companies, and in other instances were more along the lines of utility tokens. And this guy was a real bad apple. There was about 6,000 Bitcoin got stolen from the exchange, and therefore at that point he was no longer able to cover the amount of trading, and eventually the amount of capital ran out. And as you'll hear a little bit later on, there are strict net capital requirements that a broker dealer needs to go ahead and follow. So in any case, this guy is still spending a little bit of time in prison.
I'll start off by saying quickly that 2018 or there, right thereabouts, during the time which some of these enforcement actions were ongoing, the SEC put out a statement focusing on blockchain technology, and in it stated, hey, any facility that facilitates the issuance of digital asset securities and ICOs and secondary trading in those digital assets may be acting as a broker or dealer and thus required to register with the SEC and become a member of FINRA. Of course, with very limited exceptions, the U.S. Securities Exchange Act requires registration with the SEC of broker dealers that affect transactions in securities. The Exchange Act, SEC rules, and SRO rules, i.e. FINRA, prescribe a pretty extensive scheme of regulation for broker dealers. So great, what is a broker? Well, a broker is defined as any person engaged in the business of effecting transactions and securities for the account of others. That phrase and its terms aren't defined by statute or rule, but the courts and the SEC, have taken a pretty expansive view of the scope of those terms. SEC and the courts typically apply a facts and circumstances analysis when evaluating whether a person may have acted as a broker, no single prong being dispositive. You know, some of the enforcement cases Dan was talking about are good examples of that. So what does it mean to be engaged in the business of affecting securities transactions? Well, courts have read engaged in the business as connotating a certain regularity of participation and a person participating in purchasing and selling securities rather than a few isolated transactions. You know, two factors here to quickly hit on that are pretty important is whether there is a regularity of the business, i.e. the number of transactions and clients at issue and the dollar amount of the securities sold. Besides regularity of the business, courts and the SEC have identified certain other factors that indicate that a person may be quote unquote engaged in the business. These would include receiving transaction-based compensation, holding oneself out as a broker or otherwise helping execute trades or transactions of securities, including digital asset securities, or soliciting transactions. So a broker needs to be doing all this for the account of others. So what does that mean? That means the person is affecting transactions and securities for others, not itself. The firm that is affecting transactions solely on its own behalf generally, of course, would not be considered to be a broker. Compensation. So in SEC guidance and enforcement actions, the agency has stated receiving commissions or other transaction-related compensation is one of the determinative factors when we decide whether a person is a, quote, broker and subject to the registration requirements. Transaction-based comp refers to compensation directly or indirectly based on the size, value, or completion of a securities transaction. and that comp need not be in fiat currency. Transaction-based comp can be in the form of cryptocurrency, digital asset securities, or some other type of consideration, maybe equity or tail compensation. In examining a compensation arrangement, the SEC has emphasized it would look behind the terms of an arrangement to determine its true economic substance and intent, that is, to determine whether it's transaction-related. The receipt of transaction-based compensation often indicates that a person is engaged in the business of effecting securities transactions for others. So what do we mean by effecting securities transactions? Well, courts and the SEC have determined that a person affects transaction and securities if they're involved in key points in the chain of distribution. Well, great. What the heck is that? Well, that can be a lot of things. It can be assisting the issuer structure transactions, helping to identify purchasers, screening persons, being involved in negotiations, taking, routing, matching orders, or facilitating the execution of a securities transaction, preparing confirms, handling customer funds or securities, which could include Bitcoin or other crypto assets. And before moving on, we should of course hit on what is a dealer. A dealer is defined as any person engaged in the business of buying and selling securities for that person's own account. That excludes a person that buys or sells securities for his own account, or pardon me, for others. To be a dealer, typically a person has to both buy and sell securities. A dealer purchases and sells securities often in principal transactions, where it buys securities from customers, takes them into inventory, and perhaps then sells out of that inventory. And like the definition of a broker, for someone to be a dealer, they have to be engaged in the business of buying and selling securities. There has to be some regularity that's part of their true business. So isolated or singular transactions probably don't make a person a dealer. In this space, we'd be remiss if we didn't hit on a few entities and groups that typically are not considered to be a broker or dealer. One to hit on quickly, M&A brokers, folks who help people buy and sell businesses, operating businesses, I should say, and even if those are structured as a stock sale. Another big one, of course, bulletin boards, matchmaking services. These have come to play a pretty significant role in capital formation in recent years, particularly with 506C and offerings gaining some traction. Matchmaking sites generally rely on the internet, of course, to match or introduce potential investors to companies that are trying to raise capital. However, to avoid registration as a broker-dealer, those sites typically limit their activities, i.e. they do not receive compensation based solely on the purchase or sale of a security, and they certainly try to avoid, or do not, I should say, handle customer funds and securities. Another issue that comes up here, typically, I should also say, an issuer and its associated persons, i.e. officers and directors, typically are not deemed to be a broker or dealer as well, absent relatively unusual circumstances. So with that, I will turn it over to Rick to talk a little bit about what the heck is an exchange.
Sure. Thanks, Peter. So one of the key points to keep in mind, just finishing up on what Peter mentioned, is if someone receives transaction-related compensation, i.e. compensation connected to the closing of an offering or sale of securities, whether it's the entire offering or parts of the offering, they very well may be a broker dealer. And people have to remember that there's issuers are not required to register as broker dealers, but if an issuer pays its employees transaction-based comp, then those employees and the broker dealer, the issuer itself may have to register as a broker dealer. So in some of these cases, the SEC has said that the parties should have been registered as an exchange. Now, an exchange is defined in the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 as a party that brings together multiple buyers and sellers using non-discretionary methods. Okay, what does that mean, non-discretionary methods? Well, in this world, that means electronic trading systems. So if you design a computerized system that brings together a buyer and a seller, multiple buyers and sellers of something that is a security, and you have to remember Chairman Clayton at the SEC has pretty much said that almost all of these digital assets are securities. So if you are running a platform to bring together multiple buyers and sellers of digital assets that are securities, you're acting as an exchange. And if you are acting as an exchange, you have to register as an exchange with the SEC. Now, there are exemptions under Rule 3B16. You know, it does point out what is an exchange. Again, if you're merely routing orders, you're not an exchange. If you're operating a single registered market maker to display its own orders to parties, that's not an exchange. A system that allows persons to enter orders for execution against bids and offers of a single dealer. So if a brokerage firm offers its own platform to interact with people and doesn't allow those orders to interact with each other, so the dealer interacts with the clients, that would not be an exchange. So in the regulation that was adopted at the beginning of my career in this industry at the end of 1998, called Regulation ATS for Alternative Trading Systems, the SEC actually outlined a number of examples of platforms that would be an exchange. They also outlined a number of examples of platforms that wouldn't be exchanges. Now, I'm going to take an aside here. Oftentimes I hear people in the fintech space say, oh, the SEC is not giving us information. That is not true. The SEC is highly transparent. They publish a large amount of content. When they sue people and settle, they publish the settlements. When they publish guidance, it's available for everyone to see. It's almost like going and talking to an NFL referee in a football game. A guy gets flagged. He goes to the ref and says, what did I do wrong? It's pretty clear. So in the examples that the SEC identified, on this slide, you can see two examples of systems that would be an exchange. And the first one's a very clear example, a system that allows participants to enter limit orders and matches those orders in the system with other parties would be an exchange. Similarly, the second example is a system that limits participation to institutional investors to trade illiquid restricted securities, so unregistered securities more than likely, to offer a security. A seller notifies the system operator of the price and the amount offered. The system operator accepts the order. It enters the order into the system. And looking at the rest of the example, you'll see the SEC says that is an exchange. Now, I can tell you when we have clients come to us and say, hey, I'm operating a platform that looks like Amazon to bring together buyers and sellers of fractional interest in infrastructure projects or unregistered securities, we have to tell them you're not like Amazon, you're an exchange, unless you choose to apply to be an alternative trading system. The SEC also said that there are systems that would not be an exchange. And here are a couple of examples. You know, I'll take system L is a system that allows a dealer to disseminate quotes, its own quotes to customers, and permits customers to transmit orders to buy or sell from that dealer. So it's a single dealer system dealing with its clients. That system would not be an exchange. So you have to be careful. The SEC always points out that everything depends on the facts and circumstances. So in each of these enforcement actions, the SEC notes, based on the facts and circumstances of what was done by the system operator, they looked like an exchange. Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Peter now, who can talk about what is an alternative trading system.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, what is an ATS? Well, an alternative trading system, or ATS, is a regulatory term for non-exchange trading venues that match buyers and sellers to find counterparties to securities transactions. Alternative trading systems are typically regulated as a broker-dealer rather than an exchange. In general, for regulatory purposes, an ATS is an organization or system that provides or maintains a marketplace or facilities for bringing together purchasers and sellers of securities, but importantly does not set rules for subscribers other than rules related to the conduct of the subscribers for their trading activities on the platform. You know, as a sidebar here, a little tidbit, in the traditional world, we're talking about traditional equity securities, institutional investors may often use an ATS to find counterparties for a transaction as opposed to trading large blocks of shares on a on a stock exchange. This might be done to conceal from public view the transaction. The benefit here might also be that such a transaction might reduce a domino effect that can happen from large trades, what that can do to the price of an equity. We'll talk a little bit more about this shortly, but in 1998, with the rise of electronic trading, et cetera, the SEC adopted Reg ATS. That regulation sets forth specific rules with respect to a person or entity that is operating an ATS. So applying the exchange definition and some of what Rick was talking about and what is an ATS to cryptocurrency exchanges and wallets, you know, because they essentially function in a manner akin to broker-dealers for digital assets, i.e. they are entities through which investors would hold and trade cryptocurrency and digital assets, and that these platforms often claim to give investors the ability to quickly buy and sell. Many of these platforms, of course, bring together buyers and sellers in one place and offer investors access to automated systems that display things like priced orders, and they execute trades and provide transaction data. The SEC has said that these platforms or exchanges probably would fit under the definition of an exchange. So what does that mean? Well, gosh, in the eyes of the SEC, that platform probably needs to register as an exchange, which is pretty intensive, or be exempt and operate as an ATS. So Dan, I'll kick it over to you to talk quickly about broker-dealer registration.
About that. You know, broker-dealer registration, there are a few specific aspects and different places where you need to go ahead and register or become a member. Now, the SEC, while you would have to go ahead and file a Form BD with the SEC, which really talks about the broker-dealer and its principles and has a lot of questions about the ownership and what it is that you're going to do, and it's something that needs to be on file with the SEC sort of as a tracking mechanism and to make sure that you don't have any bad actors who are participating in the broker-dealer. To a large extent, they've kind of outsourced the process of registering as a broker-dealer to FINRA, which is the SRO that governs broker-dealers. And since you essentially have to register with FINRA in order to do anything, that process it really is kind of where the meat of this is. So in terms of an SRO, what you would go ahead and do is to start out, you would go ahead and submit a new membership application. The new membership application has a lot more focus on the real specifics about what it is that you're doing. So certain things they really care about are what's your business plan, what it is that you're going to do, what are your supervisory systems, do you have policies and procedures in place that are reasonably designed to prevent violations of law and to follow the FINRA rules? Now to follow these new fiduciary type laws that are going into effect in a little over a month, and ownership and capital sources are very big pieces of this. Now, this can take a long time. It's a pretty complicated process, and you need people who have to be able to kind of guide your way through the process, because The FINRA is not going to even start to review your application until it's deemed to be substantially complete. There is definitely a lot of back and forth with them in terms of getting to the point where you're substantially complete. Depending on the reviewer, there could be different requirements. And generally, it's a pretty fulsome process in order to get through that. And this, it can take, I would say, upwards of 6 months a lot of the time. The next piece of it is the SIPC membership. That is essentially kind of like the FDIC for broker-dealers. It does back a certain amount in terms of cash. Let's say, for instance, the broker-dealer goes under. There are a number of capital requirements that broker-dealers generally must meet in order to maintain their licenses, and so that helps alleviate that to some extent. But it is, but as a general matter, most broker-dealers need to join SIPC. There are a few exceptions, and that requires annual payments. Next is the individuals. Now, the broker-dealer generally is going to be the entity. The individuals are going to be the associated persons of that entity. And so oftentimes there are certain things that you need to do at the FINRA level, and there definitely are things that you need to do at the state level with respect to each of the associated persons. So as a general matter, associated persons are going to need to go through various fingerprinting requirements and the requirement to go ahead and pass an exam to show that they're able to, that they're knowledgeable with respect to securities and able to go ahead and follow the laws and rules with respect to securities. There needs to be a U-4 on file with the SRO for each associated person who will affect transactions in the securities. And there needs to be monitoring of the various associated persons in order to make sure that they're complying with everything. And that's one of the really big ongoing requirements, is to make sure not only that you have policies, but that you're monitoring and enforcing those policies in a way that you're able to ensure that people are actually complying with them. And now I will turn it back over to Rick.
Thanks, Dan. So Dan just talked quickly about, hey, we're going to register as a broker-dealer. So back to the world where you're a platform facilitating transactions of digital assets or other securities or matching orders, et cetera, i.e. you're in ATS land, you decide not to register as a national securities exchange because that's very intensive, and instead operate as an ATS. Well, how do you do that? Well, you obviously first would register as a broker-dealer, go through that process. You would need to alert FINRA either as a part of that broker-dealer application process or through a continuing membership application that you are going to operate an ATS. Assuming you get FINRA's sign-off on that, the firm would then notify the SEC that it's operating an ATS. Well, how do you do that? That firm would file and submit a form ATS to the SEC, which is the official notification form, typically submitted at least, or must be submitted at least, 20 days before that firm begins to operate the platform. Form ATS is going to require basic information, but also narrative and pretty detailed information about the platform, things such as the types of users that will be on the platform, are they going to be other broker-dealers, institutions, retail. It would need to disclose the types of securities that are trading on the platform, equities, national market securities, or digital assets or tokens. Description of how the ATS is going to operate needs to be addressed. That's going to involve how orders flow, how transactions are actually executed, custody issues, reporting of transactions, compliance, system capacity issues, in contingency planning, et cetera. Once the ATS is on file with the SEC, it will note that Reg ATS imposes a variety of operational obligations on the operator of an ATS. Some of these are with respect to records that must be kept so that a meaningful audit trail can be, is there. There's record preservation obligations. There is at least quarterly reporting obligations about transactions that have been affected on that ATS. There's more onerous obligations on a ATS that trades national market system securities, I think public company stocks, but those are probably a little beyond the scope of our discussion today. So with that, Rick, or looks like we have our question here.
Yes, this is the CLE polling question. You will need to answer this in order to receive CLE credit. We will be distributing CLE certificates via email to all those who answer this question, and we will give you about a minute to do so.
So
okay,
thank you for
you,
that. Thank you, Emma. You'll see that we have a couple more slides. One of the key issues that has come up with any broker-dealer alternative trading system is the question of custody, meaning where are securities and customer funds being held. We're going to skip through these slides so that we can get to a couple of questions, but I would encourage you to read these slides and the SEC guidance that was published jointly with FINRA. You'll also see that there are a number of consequences for failing to register with the SEC or FINRA as a broker-dealer or alternative trading system. These can be quite serious, as evidenced in the litigation that Dan talked about at the beginning of the presentation. I would encourage you to take a look at this. I would like to leave you with the fact that if you are applying to be a broker-dealer or an alternative trading system, you can anticipate it's probably going to take a minimum of 6 to 9 months. Depending on the nature of your business, applying as a broker-dealer alternative trading system could take over a year and a half. The issue of applying to be a securities exchange, if you think about the form ATS as the information that has to be supplied to the SEC and FINRA to apply to be an alternative trading system operated by a broker-dealer, the form that has to be filed with the SEC to register as an exchange is like the form ATS on steroids. There are substantial documentation requirements, including the rules that the exchange will be adopting to regulate the parties that are operating on that exchange and using that exchange. And also, when you begin the process of applying to be an exchange, you have to remember that once the SEC is comfortable with what you are proposing to do, the exchange is published for public comment in the Federal Register, and there is a period of time for the public to provide their comments on whether the exchange should be approved. Also, there have been exchanges in the last 20 years that have had to go through multiple publications for comment. So if you are applying to be an exchange, this is not a small effort. It is a substantial effort, and you need qualified counsel to assist you. I would not recommend that you try to apply to be a broker-dealer or an ATS on your own as well. I think that oftentimes firms get themselves into trouble. They never get to the point of being deemed substantially complete, and their application drags on. So with that, I think we're going to turn it over to Emma to read out a couple of the questions that we can answer in the next couple minutes.
Thanks, Rick. One question we received from the audience was, given the timeshare example as a security, why isn't Airbnb considered an exchange?
Dan, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Airbnb, ultimately, at least the intention of Airbnb is that you're going ahead and giving someone either the ability to kind of, you know, rent your apartment while you're away, or to go ahead and perhaps use to have somebody else go ahead and stay with you. Obviously, there are some people who abuse the system and own property for the purpose of permanently Airbnb-ing, which technically is against their rules and against law in many places. But ultimately, the Airbnb is going to be for use. And purchasing the property, if I go ahead and I own my house, you can have an investment property, but in that case you're talking about actual property. which is something that goes outside of the, as opposed to a contract that relates to that property.
And this is Peter. I'll say too, in the condo cases, timeshare cases, a few of them have stemmed out of mountain properties here in Colorado. When they've been scrutinized as potentially being securities, there's typically a third party managing, packaging, marketing, et cetera, the timeshare components. So the kind of the analysis there is often on the efforts of others prong and whether it exists, which probably wouldn't exist in the Airbnb example.
We only have a minute, so I'm going to summarize. We had a couple questions about matchmaking services, M&A brokers, and crowdfunding portals. And what we have to keep in mind, as Peter noted at the beginning of the presentation, if you are receiving transaction-related compensation, the SEC will more than likely deem you to be a broker dealer. If you are bringing together buyers and sellers and you are operating a portal that you get paid for people just logging into the system or for people viewing, but you are not receiving transaction-based comp, then you are not acting as a broker-dealer. We also had a question about finders, and there's a good story that we can share with you, but we're short on time. But finders, again, can't receive transaction-related comp. The famous case of Paul Anka, who was a singer in the 1950s and 60s, got a letter from the SEC saying that he can make introductions and get paid for his Rolodex. The SEC has taken a view that that letter is not something that they want to see repeated and that they want to see people who are receiving transaction-based comp registering as a broker-dealer. And if you're bringing together multiple buyers and sellers of securities using technology, you either have to register as an exchange or a broker-dealer operating an alternative trading system. I'd like to say thank you to everyone for participating in this webinar. We find that it's very helpful to get the information out to the public because we know everybody is trying to do this. We don't want to see people being sued by the SEC. So if you have questions about this presentation or any other matter, the contact details for the members of the team are included in this presentation. This presentation will be made available on the web with additional resource materials in a format that can be downloaded, PDF, and then also we will have a replay of the presentation. We thank you for attending, and if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to contact us. Have a good day.